oftentimes the immediate thought when you talk about insider trading is someone at the listing exchange probably knew, but it's not necessarily the platforms. There's enough people who could have access to this sort of information by virtue of being part of a project that's being listed, maybe an investor, and crypto is not going to manifest its potential if it's ultimately markets that are driven by insiders.
Hello, and welcome to Public Key, the podcast from Chainalysis. This is your host, Ian Andrews. The crypto industry is still celebrating the watershed moment of Bitcoin spot ETFs being approved here in the US. But we have to remember that the biggest concern from the SEC was around market manipulation. Today I speak to Chen Arad, co-founder and CXO at Solidus Labs, who reminds us that the fundamental infrastructural challenge still remains, and there's a lot of work that has to be done in order to essentially live up to the trust given to us with that ETF approval. We discuss the need for market surveillance to ensure fair and transparent trading, and especially the challenges of monitoring market manipulation and the need to approach the problem with both on and off-chain data. We also get into some recent research conducted by Solidus into insider trading and wash trading. Before we jump into the episode, don't forget, the Chainalysis Links Conference is next week in New York City on April 9th and 10th. The event has riveting keynotes, panel discussions, and a range of training workshops. It's sold out the last 2 years in a row, so buy your ticket today as you're listening to this episode and join us next week. We'll also be bringing Public Key on the road and recording new episodes in our annual Live from Links series. So if you want to meet me and some future guests of the podcast, I will see you in the Big Apple. A link to register for the event is in the show notes. Last thing before you jump into the episode, we do talk a lot about the market and different tokens in the episode, but remember that this podcast is for informational purposes only and not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, or investment advice. Listeners should consult their own advisors before making these types of decisions. Today, I'm joined by my friend and CXO at Solidus Labs, Chen Arad. Chen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. And, you know, I probably mentioned to you at some point, my name is very confusing. It's spelled Chen, but it's actually pronounced Chen, which is, you know, from Israel, we have those biblical sounds in Hebrew. But I don't expect everyone to be able to pronounce it. So you can call me Chen, but just as an icebreaker.
I love it. I am notoriously poor at pronouncing people's names correctly. And it drives me crazy because my name frequently gets mispronounced or people will call me Andrew, you know, misreading my last name. So I'm very sensitive to it. Thank you for correcting me. I need to work on my Hebrew so that I can make that sound. We'll do that offline, though. I won't put people through it here on the podcast. Chen, you and I have been talking about doing this for quite a while. I think maybe close to a year. So I'm super happy that you're here. I'm sure people have heard that are listening to this podcast have heard of your company. I actually want to start with your background a little bit because I think you have an unusually circuitous path to working in crypto. So maybe give us your crypto origin story.
Absolutely. And I should mention that I'm very much the exception among our founding and leadership team. Most of us have a deep banking and traditional finance technology background. My two co-founders came from Goldman, many others on our team. I, however, as mentioned, is the exception. I actually used to be a journalist before founding Solidus. You know, in the Israeli military, I served in the press corps. And after that, got just fascinated with the world of journalism and started doing a lot of writing, television broadcast, both in Israel and from the US when I moved here for school. So while I was in college, Brandeis University, shout out to the judges, I did a lot of reporting, coverage of many, many various topics, all the way from finance and technology, which obviously has become very relevant to my favorite topic, which was actually writing about food. I'll say one thing about that. It's obviously rather unusual. I don't meet a lot of people who, you know, started as journalists and became entrepreneurs. In the journalism world, it always feels a little bit like a sellout. But I'm actually consistently amazed by how similar the core of the work is that I used to do then to what it is today. Journalism is a lot about finding complex but important issues and turning them into compelling stories. And at the end of the day, entrepreneurship, business is very much about that. And you as a marketing leader would absolutely know that. So unusual background, but somehow surprisingly relevant until today.
It's amazing. And I love the point you made there because storytelling, I think in early technology markets, is one of the things that people tend to miss. They build a cool product and they want to tell everyone about the product and they forget that, you know, for most people who probably weren't working on the product, they don't care. You have to give them a reason to care. And that is the story that, you know, helps them appreciate the problem that you discovered that led you to build the product in the first place?
That's such an important point. And yeah. I think it's particularly pertinent in crypto because we are so enthusiastic as an industry about the technology that we sometimes forget that over-technologizing, and I'm sorry, English is not my native language, so I might be a bit flexible with how I use it sometimes, but over-technologizing it, you know, is not necessarily the best way to reach public adoption, to speak to regulators. And we have tended to do that historically. I actually think that thanks to the leadership of many folks like yourself, we've gotten better at it as an industry over the years.
Yeah. Tell me about the time, like, when did you first encounter crypto?
It's funny, in the quick little warm-up conversation we had right before this, we talked a little bit about inspirations. And in my case, very much through my co-founder and dear friend, Asaf Meir. Him and I were actually college buddies. Throughout college, we were always like, at some point, we should start a startup. I ended up staying there for another few years of school. He ended up going to work for Goldman Sachs. And, you know, I should say right off the top that I've always found Asaf inspiring, and I've always knew that he's one of the smartest people I know. While at Goldman, he and Praveen, our third co-founder, who is Indian and who met Asaf at Goldman, they became very involved with crypto through some of the internal conversations at the bank at the time. And around that time, I mean, I obviously heard about Bitcoin earlier on, but being very honest, and I think that's important because people always wonder if it's too late to join crypto right now. I remember thinking that in 2017. being very honest, really engaging with it and becoming excited about the possibilities it brings to make finance more accessible, to create more optionality in how we manage our wealth. That's when I got really excited. And, you know, and I guess... the rest is history.
That's amazing. So around the time that Asaf and your third co-founder, Praveen, started discovering crypto at Goldman, they turned you onto it as well. Take me from that moment to deciding to launch Solidus. What led you down that path?
What led me down the path is very much Asaf's leadership. Yeah. Again, we were always interested in entrepreneurship and trying something. It obviously converged with us becoming increasingly passionate about crypto. And what was interesting for us at the time, you know, I remember stories about how in 2017, while we were having these conversations, some of the big banks in the world were still adapting some of their compliance and risk capabilities and systems following the 2008 crisis. It was very clear to us that even with assets and ways of conducting finance that have existed for decades, the risk and compliance question can be very challenging for, you know, large organizations and the government to regulate them and consumers to adapt to. And with crypto or blockchain-based finance, we'll probably use a lot of different terms throughout the conversation, the fundamental infrastructure that it brought was so different that it was clear to us that the challenge is going to be even greater and that there's an opportunity not only for crypto to transform finance, but for firms like ours, Chainalysis, which of course existed, I believe, since 2013 or 14, to also transform the way financial risk is monitored and the way it's regulated. And being very frank, at the time, we saw that there are great companies, and Chainalysis was the leader, that are specialized in the on-chain transaction tracing. What we didn't see a lot of people talk about is market manipulation. I mean, that's not exactly precise because there was a lot of talk about market manipulation. You know, I remember as early as 2018 reading reports, like I think the one Bitwise included in it, one of its earlier ETF applications, with numbers like 95% of the volume is manipulative, 75% of volume is manipulative. It was all very top to bottom. It was very clear to us that while the digital asset world loves to talk about decentralization and the assets are truly decentralized, the vast majority of the activity, the trading, 90-95% is actually centralized, and that just looking on chain is not going to be enough to really understand market integrity. You need to be able to monitor for market abuse and other forms of illicit finance cross on and off chain. We set out to build Solidus as the category definer for crypto native market surveillance, as Citigroup later 2021 named us.
It's amazing because I think anyone that's familiar with equity markets, like this concept of market surveillance, market integrity, well known. There's been rules around that for a long time. There's lots of technology in place, as well as regulations to kind of ensure that there's a modicum of fairness, I would say, in the way that equities or bonds or commodities are traded. But I'm also going to guess back in 2018 when you launched the company, that may not have been the reaction, particularly from folks in crypto. Take us back to that moment. Like, how did people react? Were they clamoring for the product, or was it something else?
Let me put it that way. I have very, very vivid memories of going to conferences, you know, 2017, 2018, even the more, let's call it, institutional-oriented conferences at the time, what we call RWAs today at the time was people called security tokens. Anyway, there were actually conferences that were quite institutional-oriented. But anyway, I have very vivid memories of going to conferences at the time saying we're Solidus, we provide a crypto market surveillance solution, and getting a lot of raised eyebrows. Best case scenario, we would often get what is does that even mean?
Yeah.
Worst case scenario, we did actually get, at the time, something I don't think we would hear today, but at the time we would also get some, what, are you here to ruin the party? We thought differently. We thought it's really important. We thought it's not possible to really invite the investing public, retail and institutional into this if we're not better at assuring that they're, you know, the prices they're getting are fair and, you know, and integrity driven. So the response, you know, was oftentimes that way. It is important to say, like, I very rarely has anyone told me directly, like, you know, we don't want this. It's not important. Adoption took a little longer as the industry continued to grow. Like, I always remember that in April 2018, the CEO of one of the largest crypto exchanges in the world said publicly and on purpose, intentionally, crypto traders don't want or care about market manipulation. I don't think anyone would say that today. By 2020, there was already a high level of adoption. And I'm sure we'll get to it later, but the regulatory landscape is really shifting towards requiring this sort of solution. So it's a constant acceleration in terms of adoption. But yes, five, six years ago, not quite the same.
A lot of skepticism, which is actually very consistent with the Chainalysis journey as well.
I think
initially, you know, the company was seen as like you said, ruining the party. But as more and more serious people have come into the space, like that shifted, and they almost expect these kind of guardrail or protection technologies to be available. And when they're not, it's a concerning red flag that's keeping a lot of people on the sidelines. Right. I guess I would have to imagine the ETFs being approved, because one of the major objections to ETF approval was lack of market integrity. That had to be kind of a crowning moment, a vindication of the necessity for what you all have built.
Look, first of all, I think it's a crowning moment and a moment of celebration for the industry as a whole. I, for a long time, I think it's fair to say I was slightly in a minority opinion amongst the industry, because I think I read every single rejection document over the years. I'm not sure if that's something I should be proud of or not, but I'm a bit obsessed for the matter. And while I've always wanted and hoped for the ETF to be approved as soon as possible, I also always thought that there is a point to what the SEC is saying. Because to me, the piece in the rejection document that was really around what's referred to as shared surveillance and the ability to understand if manipulation happened across multiple markets, it really speaks to how different and unique Bitcoin and therefore most blockchain-based assets are. The way I summarize it in my head is really it was about the fact that this is the first example of a non-physical asset that is not owned or is native to one particular platform. At the end of the day, an Apple stock or any stock, you know, it has many derivatives, it's traded in many, many ways, but ultimately the spot market is usually in one place. And if it's not, maybe there are a few other ones, they're also defined. While Bitcoin ultimately can be traded anywhere by anyone whenever they want, the reality of decentralized assets is that no one will ever be able to surveil every single trade everywhere. And the way I always read the language in the rejection documents was basically the SEC is saying, okay, so we understand that, like, you know, over the years it also, of course, evolved with the industry. We understand that there are, you know, exchanges and important exchanges that are regulated and surveil. We understand that we even approved a futures market, a futures ETF, right, based on CME's futures market. So we understand that we can get confidence that, like, there's no manipulation within those individual markets. But how do we know, hypothetically, that there isn't 100 colluding actors that are creating thousands of wallets and are doing small trades across thousands of venues that are very hard to capture, and therefore ultimately the price is manipulated and we won't have the ability to know, and it might affect US investors? So that, to me, is a fundamental infrastructural challenge created by the advent of decentralized blockchain-based assets. That being said, we have to remember when we have this conversation that it's not like traditional finance is perfectly unmanipulable. So ultimately, that's a problem that there are a lot of really smart people here at Solidus and, you know, other places as well, thinking about how to solve that in a way that doesn't also impale the idea of decentralization. There are really interesting conversations on cross-market surveillance that various regulators and non-regulators are hosting. But at some point also, I think, and that's ultimately what happened in the way my interpretation of the ultimate approval, you know, it's been enough time, crypto has grown enough organizations have raised the standards of the integrity of their platforms through including surveillance and other guidelines. You know, we have some really, really thoughtful, smart compliance teams in crypto that are actually larger. Market surveillance teams in crypto can often be larger than in traditional finance and mend, or should I say, full of people who come from traditional finance. And over time, ultimately, with the help of some legal pressure where essentially in the Grayscale case, the court sort of said, like, you know, this is not justifying rejecting it, then it was time to approve it. It was a crowning moment. We do believe that our work advancing market integrity individually with our clients and, of course, through engagements with across the industry, co-chair, you know, years of co-chairing market integrity code of conduct working groups and stuff like that was important. It's also just about the industry maturing and understanding, again, like kind of like the process I described earlier, that you cannot grow if you don't address this. But the fundamental infrastructural challenge still remains, and there's a lot of work that's being done in order to, over time, essentially live up to the trust given to us with that ETF approval and kind of make sure we work with regulators and as an industry to introduce the right frameworks, again, that enable the potential of decentralization by mitigating the risks, but without like impaling what decentralization can and should be.
Yeah, it's such an interesting challenge. I mean, I think as we're recording this just a week ago, there was a flash crash in one of the bigger exchanges, who's maybe more known for their derivatives business than their spot trading market. And at least the initial suggestions were that there was a single trader who was dumping large blocks, selling large blocks of Bitcoin. And for a moment, I think maybe up to an hour, you could have purchased at a price that was somewhere south of 10,000 USD, despite the broad market price obviously being in the mid to upper 60s. And so I think that is case in point of the distributed nature of the trading venues, right? There's,
yes,
you know, like in the US, I think there's 5 stock market, like equity trading venues, and they're all fairly well connected. And all the brokerages who are able to trade on them are also fairly well connected. So there's very rarely a moment where you have a price dislocation, even for a few seconds of variance.
Right. And it's interesting. Someone on our team pointed out to me that in traditional finance, the thresholds are quite low, you know, for securities. If the price goes up or down very abruptly, more than a few percentages, it could actually justify reversing the trades. And that's not something you can do with a completely decentralized asset. You could maybe in one plot, but yeah, not for the entire asset. And again, that I think is a great kind of another angle into that fundamental infrastructural challenge. So thank you for saying that. And look, it's not the only case of a flash crash or a flash jump. I mean, these things happen. They happen even in Bitcoin, which is obviously one of the most liquid market. And yes, they really speak to the challenge of what happens in each individual exchange off-chain compared to what happens in the broad market. The one thing I would say is that once something like that happens, having a strong surveillance program is absolutely critical, because you can, with the right on and off-chain risk monitoring and surveillance program, you can within minutes understand exactly what happened and whether it requires more severe steps or not, and what needs to be done in order to put things back to order, and of course to provide a response to regulators and the public. I will also say that in the longer run, you know, one of the interesting things, you know, about market surveillance in traditional finance is that it's not done in real time. It's always usually T+1, T+2. Essentially, you take all of the data and then you look at it and see if something happened that was wrong. I think there's a good chance that crypto is going to drive a change to that with real time. If you really monitor the trading in real time and look at the right data sources, again, the key here is on and off chain, you can actually, we believe, prevent it in certain cases. But at the very least, you'll know about it very, very quickly so that actions can be taken. And I think that, again, I have 3 examples in my head at least of like very, very abrupt price changes that happened on specific spot markets. And again, what really makes the difference there is if you have a smart team that is able to respond quickly with the right program and technology in place.
You've mentioned a couple times this idea of on chain plus off-chain data. Be more specific. Like when you talk about off-chain data, what are you imagining? I can guess order book data on centralized exchanges would be one like really important data set, because that's where so much of trading activity, as much as we talk about DeFi, so much of the actual trading activity is happening inside of an exchange order book. Maybe over-the-counter trading desk data would be a potentially another source, although I don't know how easy that is to access. What's in the universe of data that Solidus uses to achieve some of the market surveillance?
So I would venture to make a lofty statement. I genuinely believe that this cross on and off chain risk monitoring function is absolutely fundamental to addressing market integrity in crypto. It requires collaboration between companies like ours, but it also requires a recognition that while we love to talk about decentralization and we love to talk about on-chain, the majority of the activity, trading activity, price formation, etc., happens off-chain. Now, because when we started the company, we really focused on that market manipulation question, and because most of the trading and therefore trading manipulation happened off-chain, it's really something that we spent a lot of time and resources figuring out the best way to address and monitor for market abuse, market manipulation with off-chain data. Off-chain data specifically, I mean, you called it order book data. data. At the end of the day, I think a centralized crypto exchange in a lot of ways is you take a digital asset, you take a blockchain-based asset, and you force it into a familiar order book setting, right? Which was developed and perfected with centralized assets. Now, it's critical. It creates a lot of efficiencies. It's absolutely the gateway for most people who trade in crypto. And it's probably also how I believe over time most people will continue to engage with digital assets, because the reality is that most people prefer to work through an intermediary, at least in the foreseeable future. But it's not the fact that you put it into an order book does not mean that it's exactly the same as a centralized, or like, let's say, a security in an order book. There's so much, you know, just the fact that crypto is 24/7, you know, with different numbers of decimal points, etc., you know, is those are pretty trivial, but they actually create huge operational issues in terms of being able to monitor for manipulative behavior. But, you know, the fact that the asset is also at the same time, the price is also formed through activity in a lot of other exchanges, and centralized or not, like crypto data and crypto trading is different to process. And there are new risks that are not necessarily familiar from traditional finance. There are also a lot of ways to execute similar kinds of manipulation differently, and therefore they need to be detected differently. But anyway, to your point, off-chain trading data, order book data, which is some of it is made public, and there's a lot of obviously companies that do great work standardizing and allowing the purchase of data. But ultimately, for a full understanding and confidence that there's no market manipulation, you do need to look at the full depth, including cancellations, including order, including all orders, etc. That's a big part of it. There are other kinds of off-chain data, which is really important. For example, we specialize in the market manipulation, market surveillance piece. But another piece of data we work with a lot is off-chain transaction data versus deposits from wallets or into wallets versus transactions that take place on the blockchain. At the end of the day, there's just a lot of off-chain transactions on centralized ledgers. And some of it is crypto to fiat, some of it is fiat, but because they happen in correlation to digital assets, you know, that's also a very important piece that can help indicate malicious behavior. You know, and oftentimes needs to be connected to what comes from the on-chain analysis, right? That obviously you guys specialize in. You know, there's also other examples, things like news data, which is quite critical. That's off-chain, you know, just simply because it's, you know, not on-chain, you know, listing announcements, stuff like that. And also a lot of other forms of risk-related data. It could be KYC, it could be other things. The bottom line is that, you know, we really specialize in the trading piece, but by looking at all of these off-chain data pieces and then connecting them, you know, through integrations that we are very happy to have with a partner like Chainalysis, and also just looking at DEX trades on-chain, etc., that's where ultimately the best picture can be provided on market integrity individually for platforms and for the market as a whole. One of the challenges of off-chain data is that it's private. And it's, you know, and it should be private. But in that sense, it can become a bit of a black box from the perspective of regulators or from the perspective of blockchain sleuths. And so, again, being able to create that connectivity is really core to our mission and core to solving, I believe, the market integrity question. I'll just mention that I was in Japan quite recently. The Japan Financial Services Authority invited us. They also invited Chainalysis. Caroline Malcolm was there and rocked the floor as usual with her incredible policy work. But I was specifically on a panel that was based on a paper the JFSA published specifically on the importance of on-chain and off-chain risk analysis to understand the health of decentralized ecosystems, which, you know, I remember when they published that paper in July, it was one of the happiest days of my life because I was like, yes, we're getting there. They get it. So just to give an example of the fact that there's also, you know, there's some language about it in Mika's technical standards that were just put out for consultation. And across the board, you're seeing that there's a recognition that, you know, full market integrity picture requires the cross-section of on and off-chain data.
Yeah, it's so amazing. I want to talk a little bit more about the risks that you touched on in that last comment. You guys actually published a great report. We'll link to it in the show notes. Everybody should go download it and read the whole thing. But some of the stats here kind of blew me away. In particular, insider trading and wash trading seem to be much more widespread than I sense the market at large appreciates. I think you published that about 56% of token listings since 2021 had some evidence of insider trading. Can you unpack that statistic for us? How did you come to that assertion? What does that really mean for us as users of crypto?
Oh, absolutely. So it's important to say that ultimately it's a sample of the market. It looked at some of the largest exchanges in the world, centralized exchanges, and essentially at all of the ERC-20 tokens or the most of the ERC-20 tokens that were already available on decentralized exchanges, but then listed on those centralized platforms between January 2021 and I believe mid-2022. So it's important to say it's a sample, but every platform is different, etc. But bottom line is that we think it's a pretty good representation. You know, we have a tool the that specializes in identifying this sort of insider trading. It looked at instances, essentially when there's a listing where someone in a very precise way somehow was able to buy the token in the few days to a week before the listing and then somehow miraculously also sold it immediately, like within minutes after the listing itself. You know, insider trading is not something crypto invented. And I'll emphasize again, none of the things almost that I'm going to talk about today are stuff that crypto invented. Unfortunately, traditional finance, someone gave me the estimation that 10 to 15% of all corporate news is accompanied by some sort of insider dealing. So it's not something that like crypto invented, but it's very interesting to regulators because it's almost obviously illegal depending on the definition of the asset, but it's absolutely obviously wrong because what it means is that someone had information and they unfairly used it to make benefit against, you know, just normal investors. So as you said, the finding was that 56% of those listings, they were accompanied by very suspicious evidence of those sort of buys and sells. It's important to say that oftentimes the immediate thought when you talk about insider trading is someone at the listing exchange probably knew, but it's not necessarily the platform. There's enough people who could have access to this sort of information by virtue of being part of a project that's being listed, maybe an investor. And interestingly, there are also, because of the transparency of the blockchain, there are also ways in which sophisticated actors sometimes are able to just recognize, just looking at on-chain activity, that there is certain interest from a centralized exchange in an asset, and then sometimes, and you know, there are various new ways because of the transparency of decentralized assets that MNPI, material non-public information, could be created.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, I mean, look, we think long and hard every time before we, as I'm sure you do, every time before we publish research like that, because we are part of the industry, we want it to succeed. We're huge believers that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and markets that aren't fair don't last, and that crypto is not going to manifest its potential if it's ultimately, you know, markets that are driven by insiders. That was the kind of main takeaway from that report. And again, it's very interesting to regulators because insider dealing, unlike, say, if you talk about, I don't know, block level front running, it's something that regulators and law enforcement agencies really, really get. Yeah. And I will mention that there have been a couple of cases in the US, one of them with a former Coinbase employee and one of them with a former OpenSea employee that actually ended in jail sentences.
It's a very serious problem, I think. The other one that came up for me reading the report was about wash trading. And we've done some research on this as well at Chainalysis. And it's interesting because there's certain platforms that actually seem to encourage it. You know, a number of marketplaces that have, you know, a reward system for trading. And depending on the economic model that's applied to that reward system, it can be very lucrative to pay the gas fees to send an asset back and forth to yourself, you know, two wallets that you control, collect the reward for the trade, and then, you know, you're profiting from not real activity. I'm kind of curious, like you made the comment that insider trading obviously makes an unfair market that ultimately doesn't last, right? Only fair markets kind of become enduring. Would you apply the same logic to wash trading? Because it does seem like some folks, they're encouraging it to demonstrate traction on a platform and kind of build a following.
Yeah, well, I think the bottom line is it real traction or is it made up traction? And look, I mean, we come from marketing and content, and you know, there's always an element of like, you need to get things going, you need to create some traction. But let's talk about the wash trading report for a second, because it is, I would say, a little different for a few reasons. Insider trading, you know, at the end of the day is very straightforward. Wash trading, you know, let's define it briefly. Ultimately, it's about non-economical trading. It's essentially where one trader or through a collusion between a few of them trade back and forth to create volume without the price changing, right? It's essentially about artificially inflating volumes. So obviously, while the insider trading report really looked at that cross-section between on and off chain, decentralized exchanges and centralized exchanges, wash trading, we really looked up purely at decentralized liquidity pools. And obviously trading there works mechanically different, right? It's not the same kind of order book mechanism and bid and ask. And wash trading has been defined based on, you know, a centralized order book. You know, the wash trading, we proposed essentially a definition that we believe aligns with the original definition of wash trading. But really it's about understanding when a particular actor creates artificial volume. In that particular case, and by the way, it's detailed really well in the report and written by people who are way smarter than me. So for anyone who's interested, I really suggest digging into it. It's available for free. But basically, we looked specifically for what we anticipated would be problematic liquidity pools, mostly on Uniswap, which at the end of the day is the largest and most significant decentralized trading protocol. And there are a few definitions that go into it, but specifically, we looked at cases where one wallet or a group of very clearly associated wallets are responsible for providing more than 90% of the liquidity to a particular pool, and then is also responsible for more than 50% of the swaps, either directly from the same wallet or again through other wallets. Obviously, when you have a situation like that, it does not look like real trading. By the way, it's not necessarily illegal. It's unregulated trading. But do we think that it's, you know, legitimate liquidity? I think there are some questions around it. Obviously, we're interested in market manipulation as a whole. Part of the reason it was important for us to demonstrate that this does exist, and unfortunately, not at a small amount. We found around $2 billion worth of wash traded assets using that scheme. And by the way, tell me if you agree, but I've always felt that there's a bit of a sentiment that wash trading and artificial volume is not possible on DEXs because it's not profitable, the gas fees are too high, which all of it is correct. But the bottom line is that using our tech, we were able to find quite a bit of this. And really, when we limited it to a small segment, you know, like to a small subsection of DEXs, what I will say is that the insider trading report, my hunch is that it does extrapolate for the broader industry. The wash trading one doesn't, because we did specifically look for places where that might happen. So, you know, I think we looked at around 30,000 liquidity pools, and again, based on those very specific definitions, and about 67% of them had evidence of this sort of behavior. I don't think that 67% extrapolates for the entire decentralized exchange landscape. Yeah. So it is important to say that I actually think that if you look at it, it's potentially very good news. It shows to regulators that, yes, there is wash trading, but it's generally contained. And again, there's more research to be done, and we are working with a lot of decentralized exchanges in order to understand how, again, you can monitor for these risks without limiting decentralization. But I actually thought it was good news because it's not that common. The last point I would say, and I am sorry, I tend to talk a lot, so feel free to just tell me to move on to the next one. But the last thing I'll just say briefly is that about 50% of the liquidity pairs that we looked at included one token that we also assessed to be a malicious, hard-coded smart contract scam. Now, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, if you deploy like a hard-coded rug pull scam as a token and you want to get people to invest in it, they might not know that there's pieces of code that mean that you can deposit and not withdraw, etc. One of the best ways to make people feel like it's legit is create some liquidity around it.
Yeah.
But that's not the only case in which it happens. We've also identified cases where they're completely, or at least seemingly legitimate tokens, in which case we suspect it might be money laundering or who knows. But the bottom line is that the volume does not seem legitimate.
Yeah. It's consistent with research that we've done as well, which is indicative that there's a class of tokens that get deployed on the Ethereum network. And this would probably apply to other networks as well, but we specifically focused on Ethereum as just the biggest one, where a small number of individuals are creating new tokens, deploying them, creating enough liquidity that they can actually list on a DEX, promoting it in some way, drawing in investor liquidity, and then running off with you know, a real asset, whatever the trading pair that was deposited actually is. In individual instance, most of these are relatively small, right? This isn't like dog with hat or, you know, Pepe coin or something like that. It's stuff that, you know, 99% of people that participate in the ecosystem have never heard of, where it's, you know, thousands of dollars of liquidity are being stolen. But there were some outliers that were quite a bit larger. So, and I think wash trading is just one of a few tactics that can be used to promote some interest and followership, you know, often combined with the social media campaign, often combined with like conspirators who are working alongside that are maybe legitimate trades in the context of being multiple parties, not just a single person trading with themselves, but it's coordinated trading activity. So my advice to everyone is operate with caution. There's likely somebody on the other side of the trade that has more information than you do.
Absolutely. And look, and it's true again in traditional finance. I cannot stress that enough. Yeah, I mean, I think JP Morgan just got a massive fine for issues with their surveillance system, and it happens. You always have to be cautious, and we as an industry need to not let our enthusiasm make us forget to remind people that at the end of the day, you have to be cautious, specifically when it's a new trading environment rooted in you know, new technology and when there's so much FOMO. So
yeah.
And you guys, I read all of your reports. You've done incredible work also exposing some of this stuff.
Well, thank you. We're running out of time here. I want to make sure that we hit on my favorite and customary closing question, which is you all have built an amazing business over the last 6 years. You've made a lot of progress even bringing to the forefront this concept of market surveillance as being necessary and useful in the world of blockchain and cryptocurrency. Where do we go from here? What's on the horizon over the next year that you're really excited about?
Well, knock on wood, and I'll actually knock here on wood, I think there's a lot of signals that indicate we're entering a bull market. A bull market is, you know, an incredible moment always, and you know, we've been through a few by now. So, you know, you need to be careful and take things with a grain of salt. But with a bull market, of course, volumes increase, interest increase, more investors come in, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we have an opportunity to show that we've learned from the last few rounds. You know, it's funny. I was just in Singapore for our Dacom Singapore event, and I've spent a lot of time there recently and really became inspired with Lee Kuan Yew, the founding father of Singapore. Just an incredible, incredible thinker. One of our employees there, shout out to Justin Lin, gave me the book as a present, and I've been diving into it. And so I was kind of looking to see if I can use a quote about crypto from him. but believe it or not, the grandmaster of Singapore has not wrote a lot about crypto. But what he does write a lot about is complacency. And complacency as a killer of motivation. The fact that when things go really well, we tend to expect to get more for less hard work. And I think this is very relevant for this moment. So I think one of the most important things is that And you know, companies like ours really need to champion that. One of the most important things is that we cannot take the risk of people forgetting how important it is to build compliantly, work with regulators. Now is the time to work harder to provide the best market integrity standards and invest more, you know, with the hopefully all of the new profits that will come in, invest more in building safely, not less. More specifically, you know, we've been seeing regulators increasingly maturing their approach to the industry from a focus on AML, preventing money laundering and financial terrorism, where of course, say, I know so many of them use your incredible technology, but they're increasingly maturing their approach to also look at market integrity and comprehensive programs in the next 2 to 5 years. Having market surveillance in place and thoughtful market surveillance programs is going to be critical. We as an industry need to constantly think, how does that translate into smart compliance programs, right? Requirements are one thing. How do we take the more clarity the regulator provided us and turn it into compliance programs using the right technologies like Chainalysis and Solidus that enable the merits but mitigate the risks. Specifically, I think there's going to be a lot of very interesting conversations on this cross-market surveillance piece, because ultimately over time, you're seeing markets like Europe, which is already cross-border. There's a lot of potential to understanding how trading in individual centralized exchanges corresponds with one another and with the on-chain market, which is also expected to grow. And then beyond that, I'll just say the classic things that I think we're all thinking about. I'm already seeing a lot of institutional adoption. I think we're going to be seeing really interesting institutional buy-in into products like staking, into products like real-world assets. And there are a lot of questions that we are thinking about, as I know you are, and I know regulators are, in terms of how do we, in those contexts as well, mitigate the risks in order to enable the potential. So it was a bit of a kitchen sink answer, but I hope that it makes sense. Most importantly, now's the time to work harder to enable compliant, safe, and regulated services, not less hard.
I love that perspective. That's a terrific place to finish the conversation. Hen, this has been amazing. I hope to see it in person soon. We can continue the conversation.
Hopefully at Lynx. I hope I'm not dating this episode, but Lynx is coming up. Can't wait to see you.
I will be there, as will a few thousand of our closest friends. So we'll see you soon.
Counting on it. Thank you so much, Ian, for having me.
Absolutely. Hey there. Thanks for listening to another episode. If you enjoyed what you heard today, do me a favor. Open up your podcast app, rate the show, give us a review, tell us what you liked. Even better, you can share the podcast with your friends. And of course, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. I said last episode that OFAC had been busy lately, but that might have been an understatement. On March 25th, Department of Treasury, Office of Foreign Asset Control, sanctioned 12 entities and 2 individuals for helping to build or operate blockchain-based services to facilitate potential sanctions evasion on behalf of Russian nationals, including companies called NetTex24 and BitPapa. 2 days later, on March 27th, OFAC, along with the UK's Office of Foreign Sanctions, sanctioned 2 individuals and 3 entities for their role in raising money for Hamas following the October 7th attacks against Israel. Those individuals and entities, which included Gaza Now, a social media news outlet that posted pro-Hamas content and solicited donations on their behalf via cryptocurrency. To read up on OFAC's latest actions, which include detailed charts, graphs, and statistics, check out the links in our show notes to the full blogs published by my research team.